Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really excited that I and King Downing, my guest, could fit in an interview today because he's just buzzing through the Bay Area here. He's from New York, where he's a national coordinator for the campaign against racial profiling and working for the ACLU, so the American Civil Liberties Union. A very important, old, large an organization that's done a lot of important work and still is over the years. And we certainly, and all of us have our hands full now with the kind of loss of our civil liberties. So, but we're going to focus right now on racial profiling, which has been, of course, as racism has, it's been going on for a long time. I'm going to let you talk about it because you're the expert here, King Downing.
Well, as part of the campaign against racial profiling, we have been working since 1999 on the issue of racial profiling. And racial profiling for us is the stopping or detaining or questioning or arrest or prosecution of a person on the basis of their race or ethnicity. And it's not solely on the basis of ethnicity because we've had situations where people actually did violate laws, let's say minor traffic laws, and they were targeted because they violated the law and their race. And so we include that in the definition. And also we look at things that were once referred to as driving while black and brown, or DWB was a name that was very well known by in 1999. But now it has expanded to include other peoples, even before September 11th, Native Americans or Indians, as they referred to themselves, have been experiencing this in the far west and the near central west, and then we've had Asians on the west coast who have been through the same thing. And it also goes beyond driving, where people have been victims of race-based pedestrian stops, very well known in New York, the street crimes unit there, the same unit that was dealing with Amadou Diallo was famous for that. And now we've also found that it expands to other places, which we have called Flying While Black or Brown, which had to do with the Customs Service detaining African-American women nine times more often, searching them nine times more often than white women, even though they had contraband on them, meaning drugs or weapons on them, less than other people.
Women, that's interesting. I mean, that kind of surprises me, although I think I may have heard it before. Why black women? I don't want to get too stuck on this point, but that is...
I wish we knew. I mean, there was nothing in the evidence that came out of the searches of these women that gave them any indication as to why they might be carrying drugs more than any other group. But for some reason, the Customs Department had targeted them, and there were some 90 lawsuits around the country around the types of intrusive searches with no basis in criminality.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if it's racism mixed up with sexism and they like to pat down some people's bodies more than others or whatever it is they do. I don't know. I'm guessing. But certainly racism is rampant and it hasn't really ever gone away. And it seems to, since 9/11, it seems to me to be, it's yet another excuse to another thing that feeds racism, it seems to me.
Yes, it's fed by racism, and it feeds racism. It's a cycle that has continued. Part of the work here was to look at the history of racial profiling because people tend to law enforcement and people who support law enforcement tend to take a snapshot approach at this and kind of look at the problem right now. So they're saying, well, we've got a drug problem, and so we're going to set up these programs through the DEA. They're going to get after the drug dealers. But because of the history of racism in this country, we find that they constantly apply their tactics to people of color. And when we looked into the history of it, we found that it goes all the way back to slavery. The first police departments were created around the issue of escaped slaves. But prior to that, any white person had the right to stop any black person in the South, free or slave. And if you read a book called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs, which is sort of a slavery era diary of Anne Frank, she actually hid in the attic of her mother's home when she escaped from slavery, but she wouldn't leave until she was able to take her children away. And she spent 6 years living up in the crawl space in an attic. But she talks about how once a year, the plantation owners would organize the poor white people in the area into group companies called muster, and they would give them weapons and they would put them out into groups of 16. And they were allowed to just randomly go through slave quarters, stop any black person anywhere. They were able to take away their property. Anything they wanted, they could carry off. They could beat them, rape them, rob them. And so that sort of racial attitude carried all the way through the Jim Crow era, where the former slaves were now arrested on minor violations and then sent back to work the very same plantations. And then with the move north, policing continued to target people of color in the same way. And that was the cause of the riots. And even the Kerner Commission admitted that it was the racial targeting and bias by the police department that led to a majority of the rebellions that took place at that time. Mm-hmm. And so historically, all the way through, we've seen this kind of treatment. And that pattern has now set the tone for the actions of post-September 11th.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm thinking about also all the court system and just all the racism. I mean, we could talk for hours and hours about that, but I'm glad we're setting kind of the basic. Maybe you want to say a little bit of something about that, because I'm not sure that people understand the injustice of the court systems. Do you want to say?
Well, the same attitudes and biases have carried forward in every aspect of the justice system, just as it carries forward in every other aspect of society. And for people who are saying that disparate impact is not there, then what we tell them to do is that they have to basically prove it to us, because the courts have realized that this is so much a systemic part of society that any time that you see predominantly people of color involved in any kind of over-involvement in the court system, it means that we have to go in and take a closer look. And even though there are certain categories of crimes that, for example, people of African descent are involved in a higher proportion to their population, when we look at other areas such as the area of drugs, we find that there are studies that show that drug use pretty much follows the population. And so we've got about 85% of the drug users are white and about 15% of them are black, and also corresponding to the races. And then we wonder, well, then why is it that on the federal level, two-thirds of the people, actually 70% of those who are incarcerated for drug charges are African-American? And it has to do with then the targeting of them, because they are not using or selling drugs more than any other. And the last part of that is that those same studies showed that people buy drugs from people of their same racial identity. And so we don't have a lot of white people buying drugs from black people, which is an argument that law enforcement has tried to use. But most people stay within their own community and buy drugs. So we have to wonder why it's – well, we know why the incarcerations are stacked up like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's so many people that get executed, too, are people of color or African-American as compared to white people, is my impression, people on death row. So let's move into the situation now and what is going on. Actually, before that, I keep interrupting myself, but I would like to, if you know anything about the case of Jamil Al-Amin, the former Rap Brown, because I think his case is being considered right now, whether or not to give him the death penalty in a case that my understanding is there is no evidence that he killed a policeman. And there is a lot of evidence that somebody else did. It sounds like a total frame-up, a political and as I say, this former Rap Brown, who's now Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, and he's been an imam, a leader in the Muslim community for many years, and I thought that he doesn't stand a chance in these times, being a Muslim and being black and being framed. Do you want to... He's someone I know, so it's a yet another political frame-up, only, you know, it's even more horrible when it's somebody you know, but it's all horrible.
Well, I'm looking at the case from here, and I haven't plunged deeply into it, but I am definitely a supporter. It looks to me like he's been a victim of a triple profiling, basically, because on one hand, you have a person of African descent, and so that falls into that history that I told you about a little earlier. The second part of it is that you have a Muslim, and so that falls into the kind of profiling which has become very prominent since September 11th, but Muslims have been targeted historically here in this country, not only traditional profiling, because in areas like Michigan, we have the same type of profiling that Africans in this country have been going through. The large Muslim populations there have been targeted in the same way by local and state law enforcement. So it looks like he has fallen into that sort of that Muslim profiling and the post-September 11th profiling. And then the third aspect of it has to do with profiling on the basis of dissent, First Amendment right of speech, assembly, and dissent. And we've had a whole history of the targeting of people who carry out their First Amendment rights and then begin to become subjects of investigation. And so I think that long history of formerly Rap Brown's involvement as a very vocal spokesperson for the Black Power and Freedom Movement of that time has, I think those three forms of profiling have all intersected and come together, and they culminate in his case.
And never mind that he's doing such good, has been doing such good work as a spiritual leader and a community leader, because that's, I guess, beside the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it definitely is.
So, King Downing, you are the national coordinator for the Campaign Against Racial Profiling for the American Civil Liberties Union. You've been doing this job since June, and you're also on WBAI in New York, another a Pacifica station. Some of our independent media that we have in the United States, and of course, media is always so important in just about everything, including certainly racism. So anything you, wherever you want to start telling about, what's what you see across a country in terms of patterns? And
well, we're finding around the country that there are complaints by racial and ethnic groups about this issue. Everywhere we go, there are stories that are coming up about people who are being stopped or being searched without consent or without probable cause. And the stories began to swell up and swell up, and it got to the point that there was so much activity about it, and it was good in a way, but there was an upside and a downside, in the sense that these complaints have been going on for years and years by, you know, ordinary people in the community, ordinary working people, young people. But the issue didn't really take off until prominent people began to get targeted and pulled over and profiled. And so you have names like Wesley Snipes and Blair Underwood and even Chris Darden, who was the O.J. Simpson trial prosecutor, have all said that they have been profiled, Broadway actors, basketball players. And at that point, state legislators, judges, Latino judges. And so when it began to affect that group, then there began to be a groundswell, and that is what gave it a lot of momentum. Mm-hmm. And then an area where I did work was in the area of New Jersey. New Jersey is kind of the flagship state of profiling, because that's where the history of it first came out, through the New Jersey State Police. And as a result of suits that we filed there, they ended up with a consent decree that required them to begin to collect data around their stops on the highway. And that information, combined with information research that we had done, I was part of that, we found out that people of African descent were about 15% of the population and about 15% of the drivers. We found that 99% of the people on the highways in New Jersey Turnpike violate the law. Almost everybody speeds, everybody changes lanes without signaling. So you had the entire population to choose from. But then you end up with 42% of the people who were stopped were of African descent. 73% of those who were given citations, meaning tickets, were of African descent. And 88% of the convictions that resulted out of these stops were people of African descent. So you have this whole pattern of them going after people of color. And when we try to look into what the cause of this was, I mean, on one hand, you say, okay, you have officers who are racist. I believe that there are very few police departments that don't have individual officers who are sprinkled in there who have these racist attitudes. But here you had an entire pattern across the board. And it turned out that it was part of the policy of the state police. And part of the basis for that policy was training that the police officers had received from the Drug Enforcement Administration under their Operation Pipeline. Operation Pipeline was part of a two-pronged system called Operation Condor and Operation Pipeline. Condor was going after tractor trailers and commercial vehicles. Pipeline was going after private vehicles. And they were going to use the highways and use traffic stops to question people around the possibility of them carrying drugs. Well, for some reason, the Condor programs began to recede, even though there had been some shipments where trucks were stopped with huge amounts of drugs in them. Why? I can't speculate, but I would guess that maybe commercial truckers were not happy about the fact that their trucks were being pulled over for these violations and that they were being questioned for drugs. So then the program shifts to individual drivers on the roadways. And at that point in time, it even shifts to people of color. And why they did that, we don't really know, other than the fact that that's what they decided they were going to do for their law enforcement reasons. And so we ended up with all of these stops and searches, went into court, got the consent decree, and now the federal courts and the plaintiffs from represented by our organization are monitoring. And to this date, the reports are still showing that it's going on.
Well, I have most recently gotten pretty well informed about the involvement of the police departments, some federal agencies, and the drug world, making money off of drugs, and even Wall Street. And so I'm going to stick in here, even though this is not the subject of this this interview. I'm going to take this, because it all connects. I am just going to put in my own personal thing here about I would really urge people to look at Mike Rupert's website, which will tell a lot about this and probably answer a lot of these questions. We were talking about it before we came on recording here, and his website is COP versus CIA, COPVCIA, and you'll get a lot of insight into some of these things. Now, I certainly don't know the answer to why this is happening. I'm not saying I personally know the answer, but I think that there's a lot of things that people need to know. So having said that, I'm interested to know if it's made much difference. I know that in California here, two police were supposed to start really keeping track of the racial stuff, and so they could see if they were racial profiling. And I don't know what's happening in other parts of the country. Maybe you can fill us in on that, King Downing, mm-hmm. and if it's made any difference, just looking at the subject of racial profiling, even before 9/11, then we'll really concentrate on since 9/11.
Well, our program has a couple of different components to it. One of them is an education component, and that is to inform people what their rights are. We've distributed tens of thousands of racial profiling survival kits, and in those we have a hotline number where people can call if they have a complaint, which is 1-8776-PROFILE, or a website where they can go online, www.aclu.org, and they can make a complaint. In either of those places, we've distributed tens of thousands of those kits. The other aspect is a legislative push, because we believe that one of the components of community policing is that the community is able to get documentation from police departments as to what it is that they're doing. And so part of that has been a push to get police departments to agree to collect data voluntarily, or to get state police to agree to do it, and even to get legislation passed that will require them to collect the data. Now, without knowing the reliability of the data and still pushing to have auditing processes put in place, even the data that we're getting is showing that there are disparities in stops and in searches in many places around the country. So even California and the California Highway Patrol showed that people of African descent and Latinos were stopped at about twice and searched at about twice their rate among the population. And in other reports around the country the same way.
So do you think there's any reason to believe that that's changing?
Well, we don't know. We don't have a way to know if it's changing. I mean, the tip of the iceberg is that is there any chance that officers who know that, this data is being collected may change their behavior? There's a possibility. But what we really want to see is we want to see accountability also built in as well. So we've been getting the data. The data is part of what has made racial profiling a household word on the next level, because people who give belief to a community when the community says this is going on have always been a part of the support. But then as the data came out, there were people who tend to not deal with the words that come from the community but are more impressed by numbers and statistics and figures. And so now that has brought those people on board. And so we've seen that kind of value come out of it, but we're now pushing to tighten those numbers up and make sure to find out ways to hold police accountable.
King Downing, I understand that you're moving around. You're actually on a tour here with David Harris, who's written a book called Profiles in Injustice, Why Racial Profiling Cannot Work. Mm-hmm. And maybe you'd like to talk about that. And putting off talking about 9/11, but we need to do it.
Well, this is a chance to get into it, because when the book came out, the publisher, New Press, and my program got together and decided to, rather than do a traditional book tour where the author goes to a store and signs the books, we decided to expand this into a panel where David Harris would make a presentation on the information in the book, which is to say that racial profiling doesn't work, because when you target people, you end up, the people you target don't have drugs or contraband on them any more than the people you didn't target, so why are you focusing on them? So that's his basic theme, and then I'm there to speak about what the ACLU is doing. And then we've had representatives from the Arab community also there, because the focus now is racial profiling after 9/11. That's been the title of most of the events. And so we're taking the traditional look at racial profiling and we're plugging it in to the events after 9/11 and saying it's the same thing. There's no difference. Nothing has changed. Some facts have changed. Some circumstances have changed. But the response of law enforcement is the same, and it's just as invalid as it was before.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine, because of this whole thing about a Muslim and Arab, it really even widens it out, because Muslims and Arabs look all kinds of ways. Although they usually, the stereotype is that they usually have somewhat darker skin than white folks.
Well, it's, once again, it's the stigmatization of the other. And it doesn't take much to be the other. If you have a hint of color, you're considered that way. Even light-skinned, dark Middle Easterners are included in that grouping. And so now they are getting an additional level of the experience that other people have had in this country, but taken to a new level where 1,200 of them have been detained. They're saying that detained without having any contact, just suddenly disappearing. We always talked about the disappeared in other countries. Well, now we have the disappeared here. And people call us. They can't find their relatives. Lawyers can't find them. They're not being told where they are. They're being held for months without charges. And then when the lawyers press the INS to say, you can't hold somebody without charges like this for this length of time, then they pin a charge on them. And then even cases where people have been ordered deported by the judge, the FBI has been putting in a blanket appeal, which just means we're appealing everything. And that's actually a violation of law, because there has to be a basis in fact. So if you're going to appeal somebody's deportation order, you have to have some sort of material reason why this person would be held. And what's happening is that the immigration judges have to accept this appeal. They can't overrule it. And so even if a lawyer runs in and says, well, you have to provide the basis for not carrying through this order, the judge ordered this person to be deported, they're not doing it. They're just holding them.
Mm. So they keep them in prison rather than deporting them. And I'm sure the people would probably rather be deported, even if it's to a horrible situation, than stay in unknown in prison where no one even knows where they are. They have no defense.
And these are not people who have had experience with the criminal justice system. And so a lot of them are being turned, are being let loose in populations who not only are, vicious and could take advantage of people like that, but also who have incorporated the attitude post September 11th that here is somebody that caused all of this stuff, and now you've got a person in prison who has an opportunity to take it out on them. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them have been so just devastated by this that some of them have just signed voluntary deportation orders thinking it would speed things up, and they ended up not leaving anyway. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So are horrible things happening in the airports? And also, we haven't really talked too much about that.
Well, yes. What we're finding was profiling by officials of the airlines where pilots, we had some 40 to 60 some cases of people being removed from planes simply because they were Arab, Muslim, or South Asian, or looked that way. And once the name was seen, they were removed from the planes. And there was no legal basis for that. Then also at the airports, we've had people who are Arabs and Muslims being subjected to additional searches. We have one case, Samaj Kalpka, who is a 22-year-old woman from Chicago, who was flying out of Chicago. She went through the screening process without a problem. Detectors weren't set off, and a National Guardsman came over and insisted that one of the screeners search her, including searching around her hijab, which is her head cover, and even though there had been no problem, and then later they took her aside and they carried through a very personal search of her, a very personal body search of her, even though they had no basis for it. So she has filed suit out of our Michigan office.
Do you think there's any hope for people who file suit? Do you think that there's any hope for the Constitution being defended here?
Well, I mean, if we hold the Constitution to what it says, that here you have a person without any reasonable suspicion being subjected to something because of their race, religion, and ethnicity, all three of those. And that's just as much a violation as the African-American women who were searched by Customs earlier. And so on paper, it looks as if that is a winnable case. Now, what is the climate going to be? You know, justice sort of bends and doesn't bend, and so, you know, we're waiting and seeing.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, we're out of time, but I want to ask you. So, the people that carry these things out are they often also people of color?
The people who carry what out?
Who carry the racial targeting out, or in airports, police, highway patrol?
Yes, there are many officers. I won't say many, but there are a good number of officers who are officers of color. And even though among those officers it happens less, a lot of it was taught as official policy. It was official police policy, and so everyone does it. But there are also stories such as out of Delaware, where officers themselves have been treated in discriminatory manners, and so they have issues within the police departments. So they're caught in a real contradiction between having to carry out these kinds of policies and at the same time being treated the same way that the other victims are being treated.
I want to thank you very much, King Downing. You work with the ACLU. You're the national coordinator for the campaign against racial profiling. And your webpage is?
www.aclu.org. Or you can get in contact on our complaint hotline at 1-877-6. P-R-O-F-I-L-E. That's profile.
We need to stand up for our rights. My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.